Am I late, am I? I might be a couple of minutes late. I think I'm about 2.5 minutes late. I was editing feverishly, so I was. I looked at the clock and I thought, I'm not going to make it at 11 o'clock. And then I thought, well, who the hell cares? Who do I have to answer to? Apart from your good self, that is, of course. Welcome to Sunday View. It's the 26th of May, 2019. It is a very wet and miserable old Sunday in Salford, Greater Manchester, this morning. But you and I are here, that's all that matters. This is Sunday View, where I'll be looking through the UK Sunday newspapers, and we will drop in on one or two of the mid-morning talk shows as well. Some very interesting things going on in the mid-morning talk shows today. As usual, you can tweet the programme between now and the time it ends. I think it might run over the hour today, it might do, by tweeting at Richie Allen Show. Good morning.
Asking the questions mainstream journalists will never ask. This is your Richie Allen Show on richieallen.co.uk, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, and triggerwarning.tv.
Yes, yes.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yes, I think only twice previously have I been a bit late for Sunday View, but I'm here anyway. Some very interesting things besides the Tory leadership contest, but that dominates the national newspapers today. So there is a lot of that. We'll rush through that as quick as we can. And then there's some very interesting human interest stories in today's newspapers, which I want to focus on Sunday View, which is live right now on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, triggerwarning.tv, I think. We're on TuneIn Radio, I know. And the programme is always broadcasting on richieallen.co.uk. A very good morning to yourself. How are you doing? So, one or two messages. Richie, why have we had no results from the European parliamentary elections? The reason for that is they wait until the polls have closed across the continent before counting and then releasing results. So even though people here turned out on Thursday to vote for the Brexit Party, mostly, shamefully, not shamefully voting for Nigel, not at all shamefully voting for Nigel, but voting in general. Outrageous that we had to put up with the notion of parliamentary elections for the European Union on Thursday. But anyway, they have been locked away, the votes, and counting will begin later on tonight. The Brexit Party is expected to top the poll here in the UK. You'll be getting results in the very early hours of the morning tomorrow. Does that answer your question, does it? Stop asking me questions. It's too early on a Sunday morning. As I said, domination of the impending Conservative Party leadership contest on the UK Sunday newspapers, not just on the front pages. I'm sure you saw Theresa May's tearful farewell to the nation on Friday. I bet your heart just broke into a million pieces for Theresa. Did it? I didn't think so. And you know, we, and by we I mean commentators like myself, because in Sunday View I'm a commentator, I'm commenting on things that I think are interesting. We do bandy about and throw around phrases, cliches. I'm guilty of it as well. We use words like corrupt and vile and criminal. But Jesus, Theresa May might very well be one of the most corrupt, vile and evil people to ever have held high office. And I always give two examples because I'm lucky in that I do get a lot of people listening to this programme who are involved with political parties. When I say lucky, I'm just happy that they're willing to give a programme like this a chance, an airing. I'll give you an airing, Richie. And I do, and they said to me, Richie, you say these things and they're potentially libelous. Why do you say stuff like that? And I say, well, this is the woman who, not once, but twice, appointed ringers to head up the independent inquiry into child sex abuse. Twice, not once. Once, you could say, was just a mistake. It was a clerical error. Twice, well, it's a bit more difficult to explain away. I'm talking, of course, of Theresa May appointing Fiona Wolfe and Elizabeth Butler-Sloss to the inquiry. These were women intimately acquainted with suspected child abusers, and May had the responsibility to do that when she was David Cameron's Home Secretary. So that's willfully perverting the course of justice. Okay, so we've got to look into child abuse. Who will I give that job to? Ah, two women who are up to their necks in it. Not in child abuse themselves, but in them having relationships with men suspected of child abuse. Dreadful. May knew it and willingly did it. Knew these women had connections. If you or I did that, dear listener, we'd be tried. And if we were convicted, we would most certainly be jailed. That's the way it goes. And of course, when I give a second, Richie, why is she a criminal? Theresa May is up to her neck in the HSBC Bank Tory Party money laundering for funds scandal. That's what I call it, because I'm not very good at inventing slick, catchy catchphrases. And this was first revealed on this programme, and it was then stolen by Mickey Mouse online magazines like The Canary, stealing the good work of people like friends of ours who've come on this programme to reveal it. Mr. Ethical, of course, Nicholas Wilson, and friends of his who revealed that HSBC, of course, were giving millions of pounds worth of loans to a worthless company called IPGL, a company that was insolvent. And that company was owned by a former Conservative Party treasurer. But in fact, he was the treasurer at the time of the loans, Michael Spencer. It stinks to high heaven, this. Nobody wanted to cover this. So Michael Spencer, party treasurer in October 2008, is taking £214 million worth of a loan through his company IPGL, which is worthless, and he's funneling that money to the Conservative Party. And Cameron, the pig fucker, and Osborne, the pigeon fancier, and Theresa May were up to their necks in it. May's own leadership campaign was funded by this money. She is a mass murdering, justice perverting, money laundering criminal scumbag and should be seeing out her days in her beloved Majesty's prison. Prisons. That's the truth. That's not wild speculation or arrogant presenting or a guy hiding behind, you know, the fact that people like these, they never come after people like me. They'll never sue somebody like me for libel. These are truths. This is a fact. So don't weep for Theresa May. Let's have a look at the papers. The Sunday Telegraph. Headline, Gove back me to beat Corbyn. No explanation needed there. Michael Gove, Penfold himself, is in the race, along with Dominic Raab. We'll hear from him in a minute. Esther McVeigh. Sajid Javid, Penny Mordaunt, Jeremy Hunt, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, possibly. There's loads of them in the race. It's like the World Cup is on, dear listener. Why do I say that? Well, the Sunday Telegraph has a 12-page pull-out special on the runners and riders. It's like the World Cup. Maybe Panini will get in on the act and release a sticker album. I can see schoolboys and schoolgirls at the local newsagents tomorrow morning getting a Mars bar and a packet of crisps and a pack of Tory Panini stickers. I'll swap you Jacob Rees-Mogg for Penny Mordaunt. Fuck off, there's loads of Jacob Rees-Mogg stickers. Anyway, the Sunday Times, more of the same. Headline, Get Boris, Gove challenges his rival again. Now, this is the Sunday Times recalling the leadership contest in 2016 when Michael Gove basically stabbed Boris Johnson in the back. You remember that? It was fairly high-profile stuff, so I won't get into it in any great detail. Gove was backing Johnson and then peeled away and launched his own leadership bid, splitting their vote, I suppose, and giving the opportunity for Theresa May to become Conservative Party leader. So the Sunday Times, Get Boris! Exclamation mark. Gove challenges his rival again. So Boris is a recurring theme on the front pages. Here's the Observer. Stop Boris Johnson. Tory moderates open battle to block no deal Brexit. And this is about the candidates' alleged positions on no deal or leaving the European Union without a deal. Michael Gove is against leaving with no deal. the newspapers continue to allege that Boris Johnson would leave with no deal. Don't bet on that. Wasn't it Johnson who resigned in apparent angst and shock at Theresa May's capitulation to the European Union? But the same Boris Johnson eventually backed her withdrawal deal. Don't believe Johnson is a hardcore Brexiteer. Don't believe anything. Now, also on the front page of The Observer today is a story about Labour Deputy Leader Tom Watson. And the headline is Back Vote or Lose Election. Nothing new there, but Watson is ramping up the rhetoric. He, the Deputy Labour Leader, is saying that if there was a general election really soon, Labour would have to promise a second referendum in its manifesto, because if it didn't, it's going to get absolutely annihilated in that general election. Now, before we hear from a parade of Conservative Party members of Parliament, because that's the way the cookie is crumbling this morning, we will hear from Esther McVeigh and we will hear from Dominic Raab. Let's hear from Jeremy Corbyn's right-hand man, John McDonnell, the Shadow Chancellor. What does he make of Tom Watson's comments, namely that if Labour doesn't promise a second referendum, they have no chance in the general election?
I understand where Tom's coming from, and I think his expression, the sort of frustration he feels and many of our members feel, but I understand that completely. We've had to take a hard road over the last period because we're a strong Remain party. A majority of our members are Remain, and a lot of our supporters as well. But we couldn't ignore the fact that 52% of the population voted Leave. We can't turn our back on those people. And that's why we've tread a really difficult road of trying to bring people together, trying to get a negotiated settlement that protect the economy and jobs with the Conservative government. That's failed, and clearly now we have to have another conversation.
This is why I think people hate politicians more than anything. There's nothing real about them, nothing human. In the real world, we say, even of our friends and of our family, we say things like, she says, what do you think of Tom Watson? Oh, well, I understand where Tom is coming from. There's nothing real about them. What he should say is what he feels. Tom should shut the fuck up. We don't want another referendum. I love Tom, but he's a proper dickhead, Sophie. But he's entitled to his opinion, the little fat bastard. Oh, not so fat these days, of course. Tom has trimmed down. Sorry, Sophie, what was the second part of your question there? Be real, man. McDonnell said he's terrified of an extremist Brexiteer running the country.
As you've seen in the interviews that you've been doing, there's a real threat now of an extremist Brexiteer becoming the leader of the Conservative Party and taking us over the edge, the cliff edge of a no deal, no matter what damage there is to jobs and the economy. So I think, yes, we have to have that conversation, not just within the Parliamentary Labour Party amongst our members and supporters, but also with the other opposition parties as well. As I say, with Conservative MPs too, because we've got to move to block a no deal and move forward now. So yes, we now need to have that discussion about how we can prevent this damage to our economy.
Extremists, we have to block no deal, he says, which of course means staying in the European Union, because any deal you do with the European Union is staying in the European Union. Yeah. Labour will, McDonnell says next. McDonnell. He goes on to intimate that Labour would form a coalition government with any other party or any other person who wants to block no deal.
Well, we've said to block a no deal, we'll work with anyone. We'll work across parties.
You need to start doing that now, don't you?
We are. That's what we will do. We will bring people together now. We want to see the other opposition parties. We want to make sure we have that conversation within our own party and with some of those Conservative MPs who have said, like us, they will not vote for a no-deal Brexit. And yes, we've said that if necessary, yes, let's have a general election about this. But if necessary, yes, let's go back to the people again. We've said that and we've voted for that in the House of Commons. But we're now in a critical situation. We could be in a situation As I say, where an extremist Brexiteer takes over the leadership of the Tory party, no matter what the damage there is to the jobs and the economy, and try and force that through.
The Labour Party, eh? The Labour Party. As it stands, it's difficult now to see, before the emergence of the Brexit Party, with Farage and Annunziata, Rees-Mogg and others, it might have been the favourite option, or the most likely outcome of the next general election might have been a Labour Party-led coalition with the Greens and the Lib Dems and one or two others, right? But with the emergence of the Brexit Party, I don't know. We'll have to see. We'll see how the European parliamentary election results pan out tomorrow. The Mail on Sunday's headline is PM race turning toxic already. I told you the paper's very much Tory leadership centric today. The race to be the next Prime Minister is turning toxic, says the Mail on Sunday. They allege that insults are flying already. Boris Johnson facing smears. Smears which suggest that he supports a second referendum. And the former Brexit Secretary Dominic Raab, whom we'll hear from in a moment, has launched his campaign in the Mail on Sunday, saying he's willing to leave the EU with no deal. We'll hear from him in a minute. Before then, let's hear from the former Work and Pensions Secretary, Esther McVeigh. She was on Sky with Sophie Ridge earlier on. Will she try to renegotiate with the European Union? And what about extending the process beyond October 31st, keeping us in even longer? Esther McVeigh.
What we've got to do straight away, actually, is start preparing. A lot of the preparations have been done. So you're quite right, that date is now fixed. It's not that I'd like to come out on that date or I don't want to. That date is fixed.
Well, you could ask and this for an extension, couldn't
you? Well, we won't be asking for any more extensions. That's part of the corrosive uncertainty that individuals, business and the country don't want. So that date is fixed. So, of course, we have to say we need to make sure that we're ready to leave on that date. Now, if the EU wants to come back to us, the door is open. If they want to have a better deal, that's fine. We've always wanted a free trade agreement. But what we've got to do is not waste time. Time is limited. We have to make sure that we are ready to leave.
Esther McVeigh there. And what about no deal? If the European Union doesn't play ball, what about no deal?
They've said that withdrawal agreement is the only one they want. Now, Parliament has made quite clear that they don't want that withdrawal agreement. Biggest ever historical losses on the House three times. Not once, not twice, and I resigned from government on it. It is a bad deal. We're now in a different position and that withdrawal agreement boat has sailed. So what we've got to do, the EU doesn't want to move. The UK, therefore, has to be prepared to leave. And as we know, and I'm a unionist, as we know, with no deal, actually, there is no backstop. So this is the best thing we can do. Prepare.
With no deal, there is no backstop, she says.
Prepare for no deal.
Well, let's talk about that. The backstop, of course, is absolutely key. If you were going to leave with no deal, would you be happy to see a border in Ireland? Because that is the reality, isn't it?
No.
You actually get a real answer here from Esther McVeigh. And look, I have to say this every time. I'm no fan of any of these people. But it's important to listen to what they're saying. She gives a real answer to this question about the backstop. Sophie Ridge says, well, if you do leave without a deal, there will be a hard border in Ireland. Now, this has never been true. And Esther McVeigh, whom I never put down as the sharpest tool in the box, gives a pretty excellent explanation as to why that would not be the case.
Because we can do an invisible border.
So why October the 31st?
Yes.
How is that going to work?
Because
the contest isn't going to finish till the end of July, then you're in summer recess. I mean,
well, if there's no deal, no, if we will get real. If there is no deal, we know that the EU ain't going to put up a border. We know that Ireland isn't going to put up a border. There will be no hard border. So we have to make sure that people understand that.
But the EU have said that there will be a border.
That there'll be an invisible border. And let me explain this. Whilst
it
will
be new. They said there have to be checks.
Whilst it will be new. The technology already exists to be able to put that in place. And that now is what we need to make sure that we do. And when you're talking about checks, the admin customs declaration is online. And when you talk about a border, there's already a border for currency and VAT. So we know the technology exists. We've already been having meetings in the House on what is possible there. So we know we can go forward and have the invisible border.
But
so there will not be a hard border.
It won't be in
place
by the 31st of October. That's the key, isn't it?
Yeah. That's when we are going to be ready for, and that's when it needs to be ready for. And we need to say to people, this is when we're coming out. As I say, the EU have already said they will not be putting up a border.
Yeah, the backstop was always a load of old bollocks. It was dreamt up at the last minute, this non-issue, to delay, and to confuse, and ultimately to terrify people who do business on the island of Ireland, warning them of physical checks on the six counties' borders and administration and red tape and lorries going back miles and all of that. And it could affect the peace process. That was all a pack of lies. It only needed the Irish government and the government of the UK to say, we'll just carry on doing business as normal. OK, we have the infrastructure in terms of the software to do these checks, as we do everywhere else in the world anyway. So we'll just carry on. So the Remainers dreamt up this temporary backstop, which would keep all of the UK in a temporary customs union to avoid a so-called hard border. But that actually means staying in the European Union. There was never any need for it. It was, you know, nonsense. And it's been proven to be nonsense 1,000 times. Dominic Grab, the former Brexit secretary, was on the Andrew Marr show. Another Tory, former Brexit secretary, as I just said, and a karate black belt. Is he running?
Yes, I'll be putting myself forward because I believe I'm the candidate that can bring the optimism and the change that this country needs to get us moving forward. I'd fight for a fairer deal in Brussels with negotiation to change the backstop arrangements. And if not, I would be clear we would leave on WTO terms in October. But mainly because I want to get on and talk about all those other things. I'll be fighting for a fairer deal for workers, many of whom haven't had a pay rise in many years, and above all, a fairer society where the kid from the humble home, the rough background or the disadvantaged community gets their shot to be make the best of their potential in life. So that's the vision I'm putting forward, and I think it's a vision that can take Britain forward and beat Jeremy Corbyn.
But nothing happens until you have sorted out Brexit and the backstop. Now, you say that you can get a better deal on the backstop. Can I put it to you that you can't, that there is no evidence that you or anybody else can? Theresa May fought for it. What was she doing that was wrong?
Well, look, first of all, I think there is clearly a reasonable ask that we can make, one that had the approval of the House of Commons around the so-called Brady Amendment, in particular making sure we've got an exit from the backstop. And I think we need to go out and be absolutely resolute in a way we weren't last time. And I've got the experience, not only as a conviction Brexiteer, as a lawyer, having worked 6 years in the Foreign Office, I'm used to these negotiations, I've seen it up firsthand, and I think that it is achievable. But of course, you're right, it will need some goodwill on the other side too.
He's another world-class lawyer, Rab. He didn't answer the question about what did Theresa May get wrong. Marr presses him on that, we'll hear that. Listen to the first 10 seconds of it. So Marr says, well, why did May get it so wrong? Rab says, well, she took no deal off the table. Listen to what he says then.
One of the reasons is that we weren't resolute enough and we took no deal off the table. So I don't want a WTO Brexit, but I think unless you're willing to keep our promises as politicians, and we, I think, are going to see what happens if you don't in the European election results later, if we don't and we're not willing to say that, I think we put ourselves in a much weaker position in terms of getting a deal. Because if you're not willing to walk away from the negotiation, it doesn't focus the mind of the other side.
But what if you've told the other side that your preference is not to leave with a WTO Brexit? He's a real numpty, isn't he? Listen to this again. Did you catch that?
One of the reasons is that we weren't resolute enough and we took no deal off the table. So I don't want a WTO Brexit.
Why would you say that? One of the reasons we screwed up was because we took no deal off the table. And that meant that the European Union knew that we were never going to walk away with no deal. Oh, and I don't want a WTO Brexit. I don't want one of those. What a numpty. Then there's a good question from Marr. This is a good question. Can we hear it? Yeah.
But you've been in these negotiations yourself, and you've asked for these things yourself in the past, and you haven't got them. What's going to be really different because you're Prime Minister?
Good question. You used to be the Brexit Secretary. What were you doing? Scratching your arse? Why couldn't you get this stuff at the time?
Well, first of all, as I said, we'd be willing to walk away from the negotiations if we don't get the very finite, targeted, reasonable change.
Yeah, but you just said that you prefer not to leave with a WTO Brexit, you numpty.
Secondly, I think my experience was of being undermined by some others in government, so we'd need to have a very well-organised Number 10 operation and a united cabinet. Mm. And I think if you do that and you can be really credible in Brussels, that actually we mean business, we want a good deal, we want to these limited changes, but we're willing to walk away otherwise, I think that will focus minds in a way that wasn't done before.
Yeah, but you just told the European Union live on the BBC that you don't really want to walk away. You're a bit of an idiot. The Sunday Express headline, Farage, you can't trust Boris over Brexit. Farage is writing in the Sunday Express today. He says none of his opponents will deliver a clean Brexit. None of the Conservative Party leadership candidates will deliver a clean Brexit either, writes Farage. He highlights the fact that Boris Johnson resigned from his cabinet post because he was angry about Theresa May's deal, but later voted for it in the House of Commons, which I mentioned earlier. He argues in his piece in The Express that this raises doubts about Johnson's pledge that the European Union would definitely leave the UK, the EU even. He argues and writes that there are doubts about Johnson's pledge that the UK would leave the EU on October 31st with or without a deal if Johnson was to be Prime Minister. And you'll be delighted to know that's all the Brexit stuff. That's all the Tory leadership candidate stuff for today. We're going to give it a miss there because there's some very interesting human interest stuff in the papers as well. Good morning to Moinga, to Lord Twat Waffle. Good morning to Sarosh, who sent me a nice message earlier on. Sarosh Yacoub Mehdi. How you doing, Sarosh? Nice to hear from you. Hi to Samantha Jordan as well. Good morning to Samantha. Hi to Murray. Lots of people tweeting. Scroll on down. Go to twitter.com where it says search Twitter. Put Richie Allen Show in there. Press enter and you'll see the tweets to me. Good morning to William as well. To David and to everybody else who's tweeting and discussing these issues this morning. Some music then. And when we hear from Lenny Kravitz, we'll take a different direction on Sunday View. Time is coming up for 11:30. That's UK time. Always good to be with you live on Fab Radio 2, triggerwarning.tv, TuneIn Radio, and my own website, richieallen.co.uk. This is your Sunday View. Back with more. Right, there's loads to get through, so let's ixnay the old Lenny Kravitz there. It ain't over till it's over on the Richie Allen Show. Good morning to La Antenna on Twitter, who says, Richie, it's curious how both Marr and Sophie Ridge, Sky and the BBC have fallen back to the backstop argument, the last refuge of thoroughly discredited MSM. They're getting desperate. It will now be pushed as the primary argument, and I predict deep state fake new IRA summer of terrorism. They will use the backstop as the argument as this leadership campaign gathers momentum into June and July. Of course they will. Again, no fan am I of any politician, number one, let alone Esther McVeigh, but she very succinctly and very candidly explained that the backstop, I think I did a whole 30-minute segment on the backstop months and months ago and how nonsensical it is. If you were a UK Prime Minister and you were absolutely committed to leaving the European Union without a deal, because doing a deal with these tyrants, these fascists in Brussels, is tantamount to staying in by other means. It's a Brexit in name only. So if you wanted to leave, you would leave with no deal. And then you would say to them, right, we've gone now, there is no deal. Right, two things. You sell us more goods than we sell to you. I've said this so many times, I know you're bored of it. I can hear you. Ah, please, Richie. No, I'm going to say it again. I've not said it for a while. If you're the UK Prime Minister, imagine I'm the Prime Minister. Right. First of all, I would lose my colourful language. I would try to anyway. And I would try to be a bit more diplomatic, which I've never managed in my 44 years on planet Earth. What I would say is, I would say, right, Jean-Claude and Donald Tusk in Verhofstadt, this is the way it is. We've gone now. We have gone. We don't want to be We don't want to be in conflict or confrontation with you over trade issues. Now, you do sell more to us as a massive deficit than we do to you. So I would suggest that we very quickly, not over a 6 or 7 year period like you did with Canada, that we do it in about a week, that we get a deal together. Because we don't want to impose tariffs on the massive companies in Europe. We don't want to do that on BMW and Mercedes and all the food manufacturing plants and corporations in Europe. We don't want to do that. But we fucking will if you start it. And what I'm going to do now, European Union, I'm going to phone the heads of the biggest companies around Europe to tell them, this is the position of the UK. We don't want to tariff your goods. We don't want to do that. That's what I would do, number one. And the second thing I would do is, I would address the Irish people directly. That's the people of the Republic of Ireland, my country. And I would say, you've got a fuckwit as a Prime Minister, as a Taoiseach. This Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney and all these other goons that are whores for the European Union. There's no need for there to be any queues or any hard border on the six counties. No need for it. We're happy for Irish goods to come into the UK the way they always did. We're not going to fuck around. But if you start, we won't stop till it's over. And that's what you do. It's not the Donald Trump style of diplomacy. It's just realism. The hard borders are nonsense. Again, it was dreamt up like the Article 50 was dreamt up. What a beautiful thing the Article 50 process was. You vote to leave the European Union. Brilliant. You should leave that night. Oh, we've just counted the votes, have we? What's the final tally? Well, 17.4 million voted to leave. That's 52%. Right, we're out then. That's that. No, you have to trigger Article 50, which, of course, Theresa May didn't trigger for a full 9 months deliberately to ensure that the process ran right into the European parliamentary elections, of course, which I said, again, I get so much wrong, I've got to trumpet when I get something right. I predicted that this was the reason way back why they didn't trigger Article 50 there and then. But there should not have been any such thing as Article 50. You leave, then you talk about a deal. What the fuck? How many times have I said it? Do you leave your, I don't know, your Diners Club membership? Do you leave your local library? Do you leave your gym and spend weeks negotiating with the owners of those institutions? I'm leaving the gym. I'm fed up. Well, Richie, we've got to talk about that and we've got to put in place a certain parameter. Fuck off. I'm leaving the gym. Right? I'm paid up until the end of the month. That's it. I'm gone then. That's what you do. This is all a ruse to make sure that we would never leave. And of course, we'll never leave. We never will. What's that? You said you were finished with the... I am finished with the Brexit talk. This is very interesting. It was in the Express yesterday. And it was picked up by all the other tabloid newspapers. A couple called Robin and Jack Firestone. Now, people who have followed the death or the assassination or the murder of Princess Diana very closely will be very aware of Robin and Jack Firestone. So this is, they witnessed the immediate aftermath of the death of Diana. They were into that tunnel absolutely only seconds after the crash. And they're telling the Telegraph newspaper, the Express newspaper, that they still live in fear of reprisals because of what they told the authorities. They said there were two mysterious dark cars at the crash scene. They were in Paris with their 11-year-old son, and they'd entered the tunnel, the Pont de l'Alma tunnel in Paris, just minutes, they say, but it was really only seconds after the crash happened. Well, it was a couple of minutes. This is, of course, August 31st, 1997. Diana was killed, Dodi Fayed and the driver, Henri Paul. So they entered the tunnel really just like I said, moments after it happened. They'd been on the River Seine on a cruise And as their cab, they're in a taxi, pulled up to the wrecked car that Diana was in, they noticed two formal cars stopped in front of Diana's car. And they told the Express on Saturday, like I said, the article has been picked up by all the media. They said it was so vivid. It is so vivid today as it was back then. We couldn't understand why the cars were there. They looked at odds with what had actually happened. I saw those dark cars and they must have entered the tunnel ahead of Diana's because they couldn't have come from the other side. I wasn't the only witness to see them. I referred to them as formal cars, not black but dark. They were awkwardly parked and I don't recall anyone being in them. They had to be driving ahead of Diana's car, but then all reference to the cars were buried, but they were there. So these claims have been backed up by a British solicitor who told officers about two mystery vehicles which have never been traced either. Gary Hunter, the solicitor, said one of the mystery vehicles was shielding the other, which could have actually hit Diana's Mercedes. So the Firestone said at the time of the crash they didn't know Diana was in the car. Due to the lack of emergency services activity, they assumed the accident had happened a good while ago, not mere moments earlier. And as I said, it's been picked up by all the media. A lot of our listeners are very much, I think, very much still interested in the story of the death of Princess Diana. They said, "We still live in fear today because of what we saw and what we were told." The couple claim that Diana's death wasn't an accident. They say the crash was a royal thing and that other forces were involved and that they feel that something bad could still happen to them because of their going public, because they went public and said what it is that they have said. I used to interview a gentleman many years ago in Spain. He's dead now. And he wrote the definitive books on the death of Princess Diana. I'll dig them out and I'll tweet links to them because I think you can get them online really cheaply and they're brilliant. The man's name was Noel Botham and he was a war correspondent for the Telegraph newspaper. He was an amazing man, a real journalist. And his account of Diana's death, I think it's called The Death of a Princess, is forensic. It is brilliant. And it wasn't rushed out like a lot of these chancers who try to cash in on a major story like that. Noel Botham forensically looked at what happened to Diana. And he used to come on my programme all the time. Excuse me, when I was in Spain, but he died of cancer a few years ago. He was a lovely man as well, Noel Botham. A couple of mad stories about the way things are going in this country, about free speech and freedom of expression. And I know it's one of them that it comes up a lot on the programme, and I try not to do too much of it, but you can't ignore it. You might have read about this. It's been in the papers over the weekend. Dr. Keith Wolverson is a GP who might be sacked, and it's not a joke, by the way. He's got an inquiry coming. He's an NHS doctor, and he's been reported to the General Medical Council. And when a doctor in the UK is reported to the General Medical Council, or the GMC, it's a terrible process for the doctor. He or she finds it very difficult to get work as a locum anywhere. They'll find that the hours they can work are very limited in their own job as the process of investigating the complaint goes on. It's a terrible thing, right? So why is this guy being investigated? You might have come across this. He asked a Muslim woman to lift her veil so that he could hear what she was telling him. She brought her little girl in and the girl was unwell and the lady was mumbling, presumably, behind her veil. And he asked her, this doctor did, "Would you lift the veil a bit so I can hear what you're saying?" Apparently she went and told her husband. She was horrified. Told her husband. He went and complained to the General Medical Council. Now, there's been a petition by members of the public to support him. It's got 60,000 signatures. He was working at the Royal Stoke University Hospital's walk-in clinic, where he gets £80 an hour for that, apparently. That's what they say in the Mail on Sunday. Her daughter had a sore throat. Her voice was muffled, not the daughter, the mother. And with courtesy, he said, "Would you mind just lifting the veil so I can hear what you're saying?" She complained to her husband. He complained to the GMC. They've said there will be a formal inquiry over the incident, despite the fact that he says, "I've asked other Muslim ladies to do the same," and they've said, "Not a problem." Not a problem at all. I'll do that. Because you see, this is the thing, you see. You see, this story is in the Mail and it will reflect badly on Muslims. And the alt-right brigade will love this story. But in fact, the majority of Muslim women have gone, all right, yeah, no problems, excuse me. So her husband has gone and complained. The Momentum-type progressive multicultural lunatics on the far left have jumped in and they've said that the guy is basically some sort of insensitive racist. And he has said that being reported to the GMC is a threat of unimaginable proportion. The matters take about a year to hear, during which time one can't get any locum work because one is obliged to declare that one is being investigated and no one will touch you while it is going on. Imagine that the GMC wouldn't just say to the husband of the Muslim woman and to all the other lunatics on the left complaining, he asked the woman to lift her veil. Fuck off and waste somebody else's time. Here's one that drove me mad as a fan of Morrissey, Manchester's finest. Morrissey posters have been removed from Merseyrail stations. This is no joke now. Morrissey has got a new album out. I'm not anticipating it with any great relish. Moz's last couple of albums have been pretty much shite, to be honest. But he's a legend. I love the man. Despite disagreeing with him about his conduct around matters vegan and all of that, he's not very tolerant, Morrissey. Let's be honest about it. He's not a tolerant man. But
spit
it out, Richie. Shouldn't people have the right to not be tolerant about certain things? Like Morrissey's a vegan and he's halted concerts at festivals because he smelled barbecues in the distance. And he said, if they don't stop the barbecues, I'm not going to continue singing, which is kind of real diva behaviour. And I don't agree with that. But I suppose you've got to acknowledge somebody's right to be intolerant. And he's intolerant, Morrissey. However, he's got a new album out. And his poster for the new album was to be seen at railway stations, presumably around the Northwest. But Merseyrail have said they're going to take his posters down after one person complained. Why? Well, the complaint was made to Merseyrail. You shouldn't keep Morrissey's posters on your walls in your stations because he is a supporter of the political party For Britain, which is a far-right party, because he was pictured on a television show earlier this month wearing a little badge with the logo For Britain. I've interviewed the leader of the For Britain party, Anne-Marie Waters. Interesting woman, I think sincere, not very bright. At least I didn't think she was very bright. I brought up Israel, do you remember? And she absolutely panicked when I talked about Israel. And when I talked about the intelligence agencies of this country and our history in the Middle East. She's an Islamophobe. I wouldn't call her an Islamophobe. She's probably the female Tommy Robinson, I suppose. But she's not a violent thug. Anyway, Morrissey likes her. He wore the badge and basically, somebody complained to Merseyrail. What has Merseyrail done? Did they tell the person to fuck off? No, they've agreed and they've taken down all the posters depicting the advertisement for Morrissey's new album. There you are. This is not a once-off story. This is not the exception to the rule. This is going on time and time and time and time again. And it is terrifying, is what it is. One bloke who didn't want to be named, he should be named, told the BBC, I was offended by the posters. And the company said, the posters, upon reflection, don't reflect the values of Merseyrail, and we apologise for any offence they may have caused. And they've taken down the posters. Madness. Morrissey says, with voice extended to breaking point, I call for the prosperity of free speech, the eradication of totalitarian control. I call for diversity of opinion, for the total abolition of the abattoir. I call for peace. Above all, I call for civil society. That is insane, that. But it's happening everywhere. Talked on this programme at great length about how newspapers are not carrying advertisements for certain products, and how advertisers are being encouraged not to advertise in certain newspapers because those newspapers might have expressed a political point of view that didn't suit the lunatic left fringe, this cultural Marxist progressive screaming brigade of snowflakes who demand that anything they find offensive is obliterated from everybody else's vision, field of vision. That's what's going on. Madness. Here's one. This is good, this. Amazon uses games to speed up its workers. This is in the Sunday Times. This is no joke either. In the Sunday Times, the article reads, conditions for workers in Amazon's warehouses have been described as grueling, with pressure to process hundreds of items an hour. It's apparently a dreadful place to work. Now the retailer is aiming to pit staff against each other in a fun competition to see who can work faster. This is absolute Huxley and Orwell rolled into one. Listen to this. Workers in Tilbury, Essex and Warrington, Cheshire are taking part in a pilot program that lets individuals and teams compete in video games that award points based on their real-world productivity. Wow. Sensors that track their actions feed into the games so that a worker who is faster at picking items than his friend can beat him in a car racing game, for example. Alternatively, a team can collaborate to build a castle piece by piece, online of course, as they fill order bins. The Washington Post, which is owned by the founder of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, accused the company of using the games to slyly push workers to pack more boxes. Of course. Francis O'Grady, the General Secretary of the Trades Union Congress, said it sounded like a gimmick to sweat workers even harder. Amazon have denied this, of course, saying that the players' scores weren't tracked, the games were not intended to boost productivity, but they were optional fun. That's monumental bollocks, because the company is always on the back of its employees to say, why haven't you sorted 100 items an hour? Why haven't you done more? We've heard from Amazon employees on this program over the years, through other news networks, it must be said, saying things like, they piss in a bottle. They're so scared of incurring the wrath of the foreman or the forewoman. There was a union spokeswoman on Sky News this morning talking about this. It's very interesting. What was her name? Amanda Gearing. Here's Amanda Gearing from GMB Union. This is where the world is going, by the way.
Well, it's about increasing productivity, but it's at the expense of the workers. I mean, it's not something new in Amazon at the moment. We've already got computers that determine how many parcels are packed each day. And it's based on the fastest, fittest worker. So it doesn't take into account the human element. If someone would have a disability or maybe, you know, that bit older and doesn't pack as fast as someone else. And what this new idea is that it's going to make the employees co-conspirators in that, because they're going to work against each other. And they're already working in a really stressful environment. So this is just not going to help.
It's not going to help. It's a stressful environment. And it's not going to help, says the union rep. Now the union rep does something truly extraordinary. The presenter says, Amazon claims it's optional, it's not to track the employees, and it isn't enforced. The union woman, Amanda Gearing, gives a terrific, but also a terrifying answer and a real glimpse into this dystopian landscape we're inhabiting and where it's going. So the presenter says, it's optional, it's not tracking them, and it's all a bit of fun. This is what Gearing says.
So they're saying it's optional currently, but all of these kind of things come in optional and then they become compulsory. You know, it has to be stopped at this stage. Amazon need to invest more money into these fulfillment centres and making them safe places to work. They're not currently safe. You know, the conditions people are working in are that of 100 years ago, not in modern society. So they need to concentrate on that.
Where's the evidence that you have to suggest that the conditions are unsafe?
Listen to this.
The evidence that we have is that we're representing members on a day-to-day basis, members that have had accidents, members that have got issues with their mental health because of the pressures in those fulfilment centres. We've also got evidence of ambulances, 115 ambulances being called to site.
115 ambulances being called to sites to take collapsed workers out of Amazon warehouses. This is true. And a listener tweeted the programme the other day and said, Richie, you mentioned Gilad Atzmon's book. Don't mention Amazon anymore. And I noted that tweet at the time and I thought, yeah, you've got a good point. This is unbelievable stuff.
Right. And we know that workers are telling us that they're afraid to take toilet breaks, that some people are having to urinate in bottles just so they can hit these targets that they don't even know what they are because they're determined by a computer. They're not robots. This takes away the human element.
Amanda Gearing, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning.
Get her off. Get her off quick before she says any more. That's Amazon. You thought Walmart was bad. And Asda and Sainsbury's, in terms of the dominance of the market. Now you've got Amazon, which has got basically full spectrum dominance of retail shopping online. And the employees who work for them, if you listen to the trade union representative there, Amanda Gearing, but not just her, but many employees who used to work for them, saying that employees live in fear on a day-to-day basis. Ambulances turning up at these warehouses to take away exhaustion, collapsed employees. And now they're introducing video games to make sure these people are working faster and processing more orders. How long before Amazon says to its employees, you've got to be tagged? You know, we've got to put a tag on you so that we can watch you in real time, so that we can track your movements on a computer. How long before Amazon starts saying to their employees, you've got to subject yourself to regular monthly health checkups. We've got to get your body fat percentage. We've got to find out just how fit you are to do this job. And if you don't come up to standards, we reserve the right to fire you or to dock or suspend some of your wages. Isn't it mental, isn't it? Where we're going as a race, as people, that this is normalised stuff, you know, video games. That that we'll pretend initially are voluntary and we'll pretend is a trial programme so that you'll get playing them and then we'll tell you they're compulsory. It's coming up for midday, but there is another story I want to do. Don't forget, coming up after me on triggerwarning.tv is the one and only Graham Booth. Top man, Graham. Check him out. He'll be looking at the stories, maybe some of the stories I've covered this morning. He'll have a different take on them, a different angle. Graham Booth will be on in a few minutes. I think he starts at midday, so we might cross over. Triggerwarning.tv, it goes out there. You can watch it there. It's on YouTube as well. I like listening to Graham Booth, so check him out. I'm going to finish with this one because it's very serious. Now, don't lose your shit before you listen to what I'm going to say, because you're going to listen to some of it and then you're going to lose your minds. Listen, this is in the Mail on Sunday, and I think this is hugely, hugely important, and it's gone kind of uncovered by the independent media. Cannabis can affect teenagers so severely that they end up 3 years behind their classmates, according to a study. Now, don't lose your shit. I'm not saying that cannabis is not good. I don't use it, but it is good. I know it's good. Cannabis is good, but we're not talking about cannabis. This is the problem. And I've been looking at this for a while without saying too much about it. The Mail on Sunday writes, regularly smoking cannabis can affect teenagers so severely that they end up years behind their classmates in terms of their brain development. This is an investigation which followed 4,000 secondary school children in Canada, and it led researchers to conclude that cannabis is more toxic for their brains than alcohol is. Persistent use of the drug seriously affected basic reasoning skills, while it also had a disastrous effect on self-control. Meanwhile, a separate study has found hard evidence that the main psychoactive compound in cannabis, which is tetrahydrocannabinol, THC, causes changes in the brain which trigger schizophrenia. And this is the crux of it, of course. They're studying these students, and they're not smoking the old cannabis which made you a bit stoned. and is good. You know, we know that it's good for chronic pain and stuff like that. They're not smoking that. They're smoking skunk. And I think there's something going on here. And I'd love to get your opinion on it during the week on the programme. Because there's an agenda here, I think. Because didn't we talk about on the programme a couple of weeks ago that it has been found that in the United Kingdom, when somebody is smoking a joint, 94% of the time, they're actually smoking skunk. Skunk has replaced regular cannabis on the streets of the UK, right? Right. So, Professor Patricia Conrad, who's head of psychiatric studies at the Montreal University, said, not only did they find cannabis users tended to do worse than non-users, but those people who smoked cannabis saw their results deteriorate when their use of the drug increased. She told the Mail on Sunday, we expected alcohol to have a more powerful effect on the brain, but that didn't seem to be the case. In terms of neurodevelopment, it's now looking like cannabis might be quite a risky drug for young people. If you are a cannabis user and you used it this year and last year, your level of inhibitory control in the 10th grade is lower than that of a 7th grade non-user, losing 3 years of development. So your ability to control yourself is deteriorating because it is skunk. It is skunk. Have a listen to Harriet Sargent. She's an author and journalist, and she was speaking to Sky News last night, Saturday night, on the newspaper preview show. Harriet Sargent talking about skunk. This is good.
Yeah, I was very interested in this because it's nice to see scientific proof of something I'd sort of noticed myself. I did a think tank report on why Black Caribbean and white working class boys just don't do so well. And I befriended a particular South London gang and have known this gang for about 10 years. So when I met them, they were 15 and they were smoking a large amount of skunk. I mean, they would have two or three spiffs. And this is true of a large number of young people. Two or three spiffs even before they get to school, another spiff in the break and more on their way home. And this is just isn't the kind of old-fashioned cannabis. This is skunk, which is far more full of chemicals, dangerous chemicals. And this report has looked at the science, and they've shown that these young men are, well, young people, are 3 years behind their classmates in terms of brain development. I mean, 3 years, this is a huge gap. And that they are also much more likely to get schizophrenia and to have memory impairment, high levels of anxiety and depression. I think it's really important. We've tried banning cannabis. It's not worked at all. So why not a really good public health campaign informing these young men of how they are damaging their brains and the risks they're running?
Two trains of thought on this. Chris has tweeted, DJ MZ, Chris, good morning. Richie, they've been saying the same old shit for years about cannabis, says Chris. Thanks, Chris, but it's not cannabis. Susan tweets, well said, Richie, skunk is a whole new level. Teenagers should not be doing any drugs. Brains have not finished growing till the 20s. So any drug use has potential to damage them, is used too young and too often, says Susan. This is the thing, you see. I know that the establishment is terrified of the healing properties of cannabis oil, with a certain THC content, of course, and hemp. I'm aware of that. I'm not an idiot. And I've already said, I hung out with people who smoked cannabis for years, and it smelled like cannabis, and it made them stoned. I hung out with a man who had chronic leg pain for years and smoked cannabis, and the cannabis was brilliant. It eased his pain. It's an amazing, amazing, naturally occurring plant with great properties, with the potential to do wonderful things for people. Yes, we know about what it does for children with horrendous epileptic fits and weird and very hard to contain strains of epilepsy. We know this. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, you walk around your neighbourhood now, whether it's in South Manchester, whether it's in Salford, and you can smell this shit. It's not cannabis. It's fucking disgusting. And I told you a story, didn't I? About a year ago, a year and a half ago, I was on the Fallowfield loop with my dog Jazz. It's 20 past 8 in the morning. It's wet and it's darkish. It's kind of, it's dusk. It's not dusk. It's early dawn. What am I talking about? But it was winter, right? So it's still not bright, right? And it's a miserable day. And next thing, I'm rounding a corner on this old railway line. And this guy is standing in front of me. Big guy, about as big as me. More muscular than me. Just a big guy. And the veins are popping out of his temples. And his eyes are bulging. And he is screaming at me. Screaming at me. F this and F that. And I will F and kill you. I'll rip your F and head off if you don't control your dog. The guy was off his tits on skunk. Because I could smell it 5 minutes before I reached him. And he'd gotten it into his head that my very placid dog was going to be a threat to his dog because my dog was off the lead. And started screaming at me, approaching me and threatening me. Next thing, a guy arrives behind me on a bike. And he got off his bike and he said, "Are you okay, pal?" And I was just standing there staring at the skunk lunatic, thinking, what am I going to do to him? I'm going to put him down, I'm thinking. And then I thought, no, don't put him down. He's just an absolutely off his tits, smacked out of his mind on skunk. And it makes them aggressive. It makes them angry. It makes them furious. It's not cannabis. And there is a friend of mine who's experimented with a bit of skunk lately. And he's not doing it anymore. And this is genuine now. And he's told me recently, I'm not doing it, Richie. And I said, why? And he said, because it puts me into a terrible, deep, melancholy, worse than that, terrible depression. A state of melancholy that you can't even imagine. Horrible feelings. And I said, you used to smoke cannabis. And he said, yeah, I can't get cannabis. It's all this skunk shit. So there is something going on there. And I'm wondering, I get suspicious. I get very suspicious when something like this happens all of a sudden. Why is it that 94% of cannabis that is sold on UK streets is skunk? With this drastically increased THC content, why? If it's giving people schizophrenia, if it's driving people mad, if it's making people depressed, why can't you get the old cannabis? I reckon there's something going on. And I don't have any proof of it. But you know it by the smell of it. It is fucking horrible. You could tolerate the smell of cannabis. I don't like the smell of smoke generally. Cannabis you can tolerate. And people who smoke cannabis are generally fun to be around. Stoned. You know, I came up in radio and entertainment. Everybody I was around was smoking cannabis. I never touched it because I hate smoke and inhaling smoke. I can't stand it. I might have tried a cookie once, but there is a huge difference. And these stories are coming out now. And I know some of our audience will be saying, Richie, these stories are being promoted because they want to stop people smoking cannabis. I would argue you might have a point, but you can't get cannabis. Where do you get regular cannabis? That isn't skunk, anyway. Interesting stuff, at least I thought so. I'm going to leave you and love you with that one. I've run over the hour. Pop on over to triggerwarning.tv to check out Graham Booth. And I'll see you on Tuesday. Tomorrow's a bank holiday. See you Tuesday.